realized no idea what to say. Should he try to sound like the athletes he read about in the paper? Should he mimic Schartzer, whom he'd seen interviewed once or twice? Or should he just answer the questions to the best of his ability? After a moment of indecision, he settled on the final strategy. So when Cook asked, "Do you think you can play with the bigger schools up at state?" John answered as honestly as he could. And when Cook followed that up with, "You mean you think you can win the state championship?" John answered that one best he could, too. Then Henneberry hung up and walked back out to the yard, confident he'd acquitted himself well. The following day, the Iron Men walked out of the Macon High gym toward the bus, and, to their surprise, found a receiving line waiting for them. One teacher after another clasped their hands and patted them on the back, wishing them good luck. Then came a row of administrators, each as serious as the next, hands extended. Dale Otta remembers being taken aback, because the administrators never shook their hands. He felt like he was going off to war. One by one, they climbed up into the bus. At the wheel was Fizz Adams, an honest-to-goodness actual bus driver. As he pulled the bus onto 51, headed north, it was joined by a succession of cars. From the air, it must have looked like a motorcade. Otta looked out the rear window, marveling at the sight. There was Bob Schartzer's white Ford Fairlane, and Britton's sedan, and Bob Taylor's car, his son Scott wedged into the back seat. Iron Men flags ruffled out windows, horns honked. It looked like an entire town just got married. From Macon, the bus headed through Decatur, and then continued northwest toward Peoria, cutting through a landscape of fledgling cornfields. On the drive, the boys talked about the teams they might face, and bragged about the suitcases they'd brought, for this was the first time many would stay overnight at a hotel. With some prodding, Jeff Gland stood up and did his best imitation of Burns imitating Patton. Then, it was on to reciting lines from a speech by legendary University of Illinois football coach Ray Elliott. "If you think you're beaten, you are," Gland bellowed, addressing the back of the bus. "If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win but think you can't, it's almost a cinch that you won't." Gland paused, looked around, raised the volume. "Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man. But sooner or later, the fellow who wins is the fellow who thinks he can. It's all a state of mind." Glancing around the bus, Sweet thought about how close the boys had become. A few rows behind him, Henneberry did the same. As one of only five seniors, he felt the weight of the trip more than most. Sitting there, watching endless green rows of soybeans slide past, he thought about how he'd probably never wear a uniform again. He thought about how much he loved the boys around him, this team, and being a baseball player. He thought about how, when he hung up his uniform, it would be time to go get a job, and how some of his older friends were already talking about draft numbers for the war. And, as he had before the season, he thought of how it was, as he says, "my last time to be a kid." A more majestic sight they'd never seen. It was as if Fizz Adams had pulled that old yellow bus off the highway and right into the driveway of Shangri-La. The facade towered over them, lights shining down, a peaked turret piercing the sky. "Jumer's Castle Lodge," it said. All David Wells could do was stare. Wells had grown up on a farm near Macon, where electricity was sporadic and hot water non-existent. He'd never been to a city like Peoria. To say Jumer's blew his mind would be an understatement. It was not only the first hotel he'd ever checked into, it was one of the grandest buildings he'd ever entered. Even the handful of Macon boys who'd stayed in hotels were in awe, for Jumer's was not a hotel so much as an experience. Opened a year earlier, it featured Bavarian architecture, high-class service, and all manner of unusual antiques. A giant stuffed black bear, arms upraised and teeth bared, greeted visitors in the lounge. Uniformed members of the hotel's 400 employees hustled by. Hallways led off in seemingly every direction, leading to the hotel's 168 rooms. Swede had to hand it to Britton and the rest of the administration. They'd finally come up big for the baseball team. By the end of the tournament, Macon High's coffers would cover $653.50 in lodging, meals, and other expenses at Jumer's. The Iron Men arrived at 5 p.m. At 6, Wells was still in the shower, reveling in the exotic stream of warm water. Meanwhile, the Otta twins explored the grounds, for neither had ever spent a night in a hotel. Trussner stood in the gift shop, horrified by the prices it was charging for seemingly mundane items such as a comb or a bag of peanuts. Nearby, Sweet found his own Shangri-La in the large, roomy bar where he'd received word the coach's drinks would be paid for by the school. 8 miles down the road, 7 baseball teams gathered at 7 p.m. at the Heritage House, a buffet-style restaurant. Quincy was there, as were Nashville and Rockford West, along with Waukegan, Pisa Southwestern, Kankakee Eastridge, and, for the second year in a row, Lane Tech High of Chicago. Dozens of baseball players wearing blazers and ties filed into a large room and took their seats, quietly sizing each other up. Peoria Mayor E. Michael O'Brien welcomed the boys, then turned the microphone over to the tournament managers, and finally, featured speaker Johnny Klipstein, a former big league pitcher who now scouted for the Tigers. Dinner was served. Speeches were made. The boys fidgeted in their seats. Off to the side, one table was conspicuously empty. The welcome banquet was only one of numerous scheduled tournament events. There was a barbecue Thursday night after the games, and for the players, a continuous loop of World Series highlights at the Holiday Inn. The Illinois High School Baseball Coaches Association was holding an annual golf tournament and a smoker. For the press, there was a reception at the Ramada. And of course, there were all manner of unofficial parties. For many, the tournament was as much a social event as a sporting one, and coaches and fans came from around the state just to be part of all the activities. Sweet intended to participate in as few as possible. He didn't see any reason to intimidate the boys right off the bat. He knew the other teams would be full of tall, talented kids. He knew they'd have 2 dozen players each. He knew they'd wear nice clothes and talk about big city things and past appearances in the sectionals and at state. He didn't see much his boys could gain from that experience. That's why he'd booked Jumer's Castle Lodge instead of the preferred tournament hotels. Here, the boys could stay in their bubble. Here, they could maintain their optimism. And here, Sweet could drink beers at the bar without having to talk to any hard-ass coaches who would undoubtedly question his hair, experience, and acumen. It seemed an easy decision. While the other boys checked out the swimming pool and played cards, Schartzer gripped the bed in his room. His breath came in short bursts. His face was red. His eyes watered. He tried to force air down his throat. The coughing fits began when he was a boy. When he was 6 years old, his parents carted him to a top hospital in St. Louis. "Your son has a bad case of asthma," the doctor said. It seemed unfair to Steve. His whole life revolved around sports, around being the strongest, the most indomitable. And here he was, felled by a stupid cough. The attacks hit at the worst times. He could be on the mound or at a football game, and then, suddenly, He felt like he was suffocating. When Primatene Mist came out in 1963, it was a godsend, and as he'd gotten older, the attacks became less frequent. By high school, he was sure he'd grown out of it. Yet every once in a while, the asthma flared up. Sometimes it was dust or the humidity. After what seemed like hours, the air trickled back in. Slowly, he regained his wind. And then, moments later, it was sucked right back out again. By the time he rolled out of bed in the morning, Schartzer had slept only 3 hours. Mark Miller walked in at breakfast, grimaced, and handed a copy of the Decatur Herald and Review to John Henneberry. John unfolded the sports page and scanned it until he saw Joe Cook's mugshot, the lank brown hair combed over his forehead. The headline on his column read, "Making Players Supremely Confident." John began to read. Macon and Nashville, opponents this morning in the opening game of the Illinois State High School baseball finals at Peoria, aren't exactly strangers. At least the seniors on the clubs aren't. Kaskaskia Junior College of Centralia, in a recruiting venture, invited the upperclassmen of both teams to visit its campus Monday. The players wasted little time in sizing up each other. Macon pitcher John Henneberry said afterward, "I don't think they, Nashville, were impressed by us, and I know we weren't impressed by them. The one thing they have going for them is size. The Macon boys are confident. In fact, you wonder if they might be taking Nashville, 14-9, too lightly." "I know we'll beat Nashville," said Henneberry, "and I think we'll win the tournament. I don't know the other teams in the tournament, but I know mine." Henneberry finished reading, then looked back up to see Miller shaking his head.
"I can't believe you said that, John."
Reading it again, Henneberry couldn't either. He'd just answered honestly. He didn't mean it to sound like that. If the Iron Men were supremely confident in their chances, they were the only ones. At the press reception the night before, the Peoria Journal Star had asked 26 writers, baseball luminaries, and radio and TV reporters who they thought would win the state tournament. Not one had picked the Iron Men. Judging by the votes, only a handful thought they'd even win one game. Here's how it broke down. 1971 State Tournament Poll by Illinois Sports Writers. Chicago Lane Tech, 19 first-place votes, 200 overall. Waukegan, 2 first-place votes, 148 overall. Rockford West, 1 first-place vote, 148 overall. Quincy, 3 first-place votes, 130 overall. Kankakee Eastridge, 1 first-place vote, 112 overall. Macon, no first-place votes, 88 overall. Nashville, no first-place votes, 60 overall. Pisa Southwestern, no first-place votes, 45 overall. So unexpected was the Iron Men's tournament appearance that even the organizers appeared to be caught off guard. The official tournament program was a handsome booklet. It cost 25 cents, was 41 pages long, and was chock full of photos. Inside, there were portraits of IHSA administrators, each as serious and clean-cut as the next. There were scorecards and tournament records and pages of ads. Peoria Motors hawked a car called the Pinto, advertising it as "for the young at heart," while the Ramada Inn offered "resort atmosphere in downtown Peoria." Nearly every tournament qualifier had its own page, complete with a team photo and a roster listing each player's height, weight, position, age, and batting average. Except for Macon, that is. For the Iron Men, there was only a half a page of information and no team photo or stats. The players' heights, weights, and ages were listed, but a casual reader could be forgiven for thinking that the school had mistakenly submitted its JV roster. The team boasted more underclassmen, 8, than upperclassmen, 7, and had no one over 6 feet or 160 pounds, and only Schartzer at both. The rest of the tournament field was littered with figurative and literal heavyweights, teams with 20-plus players, a handful of whom were built like men at 6'1" or 6'2" and 180 to 200 pounds. Quincy High entered the tournament with a 25-9 record and boasted a 6'5", 195-pound catcher named Craig Croter, who'd hit 365. Rockford West was 25-4 and had an enrollment of 2,750. While Keegan High was making its 8th appearance at the tournament, and its photo looked more like a class reunion than a baseball team, including coaches, there were 30 faces staring back. Pisa Southwestern, Kankakee Eastridge, and Nashville were all making inaugural trips to the tourney, but their lineups were stacked. Eastridge had a junior ace named Jeff Scott, who sported an ERA of 1.69 and had already pitched 4 shutouts, 2 no-hitters, and a perfect game during the season. Nashville had one of the top 5 major league prospects in the state, a speedy center fielder named Rick Keller. And then, of course, there was Lane Tech, which was now tied with Peoria Manual for the most trips to state with 10. If Tech won, it would continue a staggering run of dominance for Chicago area schools, which had triumphed in 20 of the 31 years the IHSA had held the tournament. Across Illinois sports, the Chicago stranglehold had become even more pronounced of late. Of the 26 state titles in all boys sports over the past 3 years, only 3 had been won by teams outside the Chicago metro area. By most any measure, Macon got lucky in the first round draw. At 405 students, Nashville was the 2nd smallest school in the tournament, though it still had nearly twice Macon's enrollment. The 2 teams were scheduled to face off in the tournament opener at 9:30 a.m. on Thursday. The winners of the 4 first-round games would advance to the semifinals Friday morning, from which 2 teams would survive and battle for the state title at 4:30 on Friday afternoon. For 2 days, the eyes of Illinois would be upon Peoria. It was already warm when Sweet headed out to his car at 7:30 a.m. on the morning of Thursday, June 3rd. Outside Jumer's, he met up with a bleary-eyed Schartzer, and the 2 headed to the campus of Bradley University. Tournament officials required that Schartzer get his hand taped prior to the first game. Not that the mandate did much good. Within half an hour, Schartzer had cut off the tape and gauze with a pocket knife, a move he would later explain to tournament umpires as necessary because the tape was restrictive. Later in the day, when Lane Tech took the field, the stands would fill with fans, and the scouts would come out en masse. 22 from major league teams, as well as 15 college coaches. Minen Field would take on the air of a college game. At 8:45 a.m., however, it was still relatively quiet, the grass still dewy from the night before. Upon arriving, the Macon boys walked out and, much as they had a year earlier at Fansfield, took a minute to revel in the surroundings. The infield was combed dirt, the outfield flat and well-groomed. Bleachers lined either foul line, and stanchions of lights looked down on the field. The fence was deeper than any they'd played on all year, and seemed miles away, 337 feet in left, 373 feet in center, and 335 in right. Appraising it, sophomore left fielder David Wells turned to Stu Arnold. "Hey, Stu, how far are we supposed to play from that fence?" Arnold peered out, thought for a moment. "I don't know. I think I'm going to play back. It's easier to run in than out." 15 minutes later, at a little after 9 a.m., the sounds of Jesus Christ Superstar filtered into the morning. It was almost time. They kept coming. As game time approached, cars pulled up, honking as they unloaded friends, parents, and siblings. Even though it was a work day, more than 200 people had made the drive from Macon. As always, Dale Otta scanned the faces from his position at shortstop. And, as always, he hoped to see his father. In Dale's entire playing career, from Little League to his senior year, His father had never attended one of his and Dean's games. Dwight Otta worked on commission as a milk truck driver for Meadow Gold, leaving before 6 a.m. every morning and returning around 8 p.m. At night, he'd sit at the kitchen table for another hour punching away at his adding machine, making sure the day's receipts totaled out. On weekends, Dwight worked all day on Saturday and spent the bulk of Sunday sleeping. In his free time, he also managed to be a pillar of the Macon community. He served on committees, joined the city council,